Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, November 30th, 2022. House representatives passing a bill to prevent a potential railroad workers strike and the economic fallout that it would create. The bill requires railroad companies and workers accept a proposed settlement that has been rejected by some of the unions already. House passing a second bill that changes that proposed settlement by increasing the number of paid sick days for railroad employees. Both bills now head to the Senate. President Biden says a strike needs to be averted this week because of the uncertainty, and railroads would begin halting movement of critical materials. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell suggesting that while interest rate increases will continue to combat inflation, the pace of those increases could slow down as early as their meeting in December. U.S. House Democrats electing a new leadership team for the next Congress when the Democrats will be in the minority. Hakeem Jeffries for leader, first person of color to lead either major party in Congress. Catherine Clark for whip and Pete Aguilar for caucus chair. And the race for House Speaker for the next Congress, when Republicans will be in the majority, could be influenced by this week's House Republican closed-door meetings about changes to House rules. We'll talk about that with CQ Roll Call senior reporter Lindsay McPherson. Attorney General Merrick Garland talking about leaders of the right-wing group Oath Keepers convicted this week of seditious conspiracy in the attack on the Capitol January 6, 2021. A Senate confirmation hearing for the nominee for U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy. And at the White House, First Lady Jill Biden previewing Thursday's state dinner with the French President Emmanuel Macron, the first state visit for the Biden administration. And now to the House passing that bill to prevent potentially a nationwide railroad strike. The bill would require companies and employees agree to propose settlement that has been rejected by 8 of the 12 unions involved. There are about 30 railroad companies in the negotiations. President Biden calling on Congress to intervene, saying a strike would be devastating to the economy, disrupting transportation of fuel, food, and other critical goods. House today also passing a separate bill that would add 7 paid sick days to the labor agreement. That was one of the main issues causing not all the unions to ratify the deal. Union leaders had asked for 15 paid sick days. The original agreement has 1 additional personal day. Here's some of the House floor debate ahead of the votes. Congressman Donald Payne Jr., Democrat from New Jersey, and Congressman Sam Graves, Republican from Missouri.
As chairman of the House Subcommittee on Railroads, Pipelines, Hazardous Materials, the decision to intervene and prevent the freight rail shutdown was not easy by any means. However, with the nearly one-third of the nation's freight moved by rail, the failure to prevent a rail stoppage would be irresponsible, as it would be have devastating consequences on our economy and everyday American life. Not only would a stoppage stunt our economic growth, it would disrupt supply chains around the world and skyrocket costs of fuel and food just before winter. We all know this would put us dangerously close to the possibility of a recession, something American farmers and small business simply cannot afford after years of neglect under the former occupant of the White House. Shirking our duty to act would inflict harm on everyday American families, with soaring costs at the pump and rising prices of grocery stores. Therefore, we simply cannot afford to idle at this critical juncture. But mark my words, the rail industry should be ashamed for bringing us to this place. They have failed to meet the needs of the men and women who have demonstrated nothing short of courage over the past couple of years. I promise to help pass meaningful legislation that would prioritize the needs of workers. That is why I am co-sponsoring a bill which will be before you later today that will provide 7 days paid sick leave to rail employees. I urge each of you to join me in doing what we must do to prevent a rail strike and defend our rail employees guardians of our economy. And with that, I reserve the balance of my time.
Gentleman reserves. That gentleman from Missouri is recognized.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I yield myself such time as I may consume. I've got to talk just a little bit about the sick leave, the paid sick leave that we continue to hear about, throughout this process. And you got to remember, what we're debating right now is the president's recommendation. That's what his board recommended, what they negotiated, and what the president asked Congress to support. But what is claimed is that they don't have the sick days, and that argument is very misleading. The tentative agreement found in this bill that we're debating right now, Resolution 100, it provides workers with several avenues of different types of leave, which are carefully considered by members of the PEB, in balance with higher levels of compensation and increased benefits. In short, the neutral appointed PEB that the president appointed rejected union demands for additional paid leave. Traditionally, labor unions have negotiated with freight railroads for very generous benefits to make up for what we consider traditional sick days. This agreement is no exception and includes a very historic 24%, and I mentioned this earlier, 24% increase by 2024 that comes with an $11,000 in back wages and an additional $1,000 a year in bonus payments. This is in addition to a very generous health care benefit, which employees contribute. Think about this. Employee contributions are set at 15%. The average employee contribution for family coverage in the United States is 28% of the premium. So let's be clear. We can't have our cake and eat it too, which is exactly what the majority is attempting to do with this concurrent resolution.
It's Congressman Sam Graves, ranking Republican on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Before that, Congressman Donald Payne Jr., Democrat and chair of the Railroad Subcommittee. The House went on to pass that first bill, the initial proposed labor agreement, by a vote of 290 to 137. And 79 Republicans voted yes, 8 Democrats voted no. Then the House passed that second bill to add an extra 7 paid sick days to the agreement. That vote was 221 to 207. 3 Republicans voted yes, 0 Democrats voted no. Both bills now head to the Senate. Some more news on the economy. Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew at a 2.9% annual rate from July through September. It's up from the initial estimate of 2.6%. This despite high interest rates and inflation. And ADP reports that private companies added an estimated 127,000 jobs in November. That's down from 239,000 in October. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell giving some clues about what may happen next with interest rates. There have already been 6 rate increases this year, and the last 4 were 0.75 percentage point. The Fed Chair Jerome Powell spoke at the Brookings Institution.
My FOMC colleagues and I are strongly committed to restoring price stability. After our November meeting, we noted that we anticipated that ongoing rate increases will be appropriate in order to attain a policy stance that is sufficiently restrictive to move inflation down to 2% over time. Monetary policy affects the economy and inflation with uncertain lags, and the full effects of our rapid tightening so far are yet to be felt. Thus, it makes sense to moderate the pace of our rate increases as we approach the level of restraint that will be sufficient to bring inflation down. The time for moderating the pace of rate increases may come as soon as the December meeting. Given our progress in tightening policy, the timing of that moderation is far less significant than the questions of how much further we will need to raise rates to control inflation and the length of time it will be necessary to hold policy at a restrictive level. It is likely that restoring price stability will require holding policy at a restrictive level for some time. History cautions strongly against prematurely loosening policy, and I'll close by saying that we will stay the course until the job is done.
The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell today at the Brookings Institution. Wall Street Journal interpreting his remarks to say that the next rate increase in December could be 0.5 percentage point instead of 0.75 percentage point. On Wall Street Today, reaction Dow Jones Industrial Average up 737, NASDAQ up 484, S&P up 122. Now to the U.S. House leadership elections. New York Times reports that House Democrats on Wednesday elected new leaders to take the mantle from the three octogenarians who have led them for two decades, ushering in a long-awaited generational change that for the first time in the history of either party or chamber in Congress installed a trio of top leaders that includes no white men. In a display of unity after midterm elections in which they lost the House but had a stronger-than-expected showing, Democrats skipped the vote and by acclamation elected Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York to be minority leader, making him the first black person to hold the top spot. Representative Catherine Clark of Massachusetts was elected as whip, the lead vote counter for House Democrats, and Representative Pete Aguilar of California as the chairman of the party caucus in charge of messaging. That from the New York Times. They will replace the current leaders, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, and Minority Whip James Clyburn. Congressman Hoyer speaking to reporters outside of the closed meeting where the voting took place.
I think we've had a great victory in our party for our unity and for our ability to move forward in a united way. Greg Meeks, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, asked for unanimous consent for the election of Mr. Jeffries. But in it, he said the most important thing in a relay race was the passing of the baton, and that Nancy Pelosi and the leadership didn't break stride in passing the baton in a united and winning way. So I think that's what happened today. We have three extraordinary people who are going to be leading our caucus, in Mr. Jeffries and Mr. Aguilar, and then the new whip. I was minority whip for 12 years, so I know that what that job is, and Catherine Clark is going to do an extraordinary job. And what the themes were, focusing on what we have done and what we need to do for the American people in terms of their quality of life, their economic well-being, their health, their environment. And I think that's what this caucus is going to do, and it's up. It's not down. We're in the minority, but we're not down. And Hakeem Jeffries is going to take us to victory in 2024. Thank you.
Congressman Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, the current majority whip with reporters. He is one of the ones who will be leaving leadership in the next Congress. Those three new House Democratic leaders he mentioned later holding a news conference. And here is Hakeem Jeffries talking about what it means to be chosen by his colleagues as leader.
I was born at Brooklyn Hospital, raised in Crown Heights by my two parents who were public employees, a caseworker and a social worker in a middle class, working class neighborhood in the midst of the crack cocaine epidemic in the 80s into the early 90s. I'm thankful for them, thankful for their love, support and prayers throughout the years, throughout my journey into adulthood and my journey as a public servant. Growing up in that Crown Heights neighborhood, first member of Congress I was ever aware of was the Honorable Shirley Chisholm. And I eventually was able to be elected to represent many neighborhoods in Brooklyn that she formerly represented. And so it's with particular reverence for her that it was communicated to me earlier today that this actually is Shirley Chisholm's birthday 98 years ago. I stand on the shoulders of people like Shirley Chisholm and so many others as we work to advance the ball for everyday Americans and get stuff done. Because that's what Democrats do. That's what our record says. Each and every day, House Democrats committed to fighting hard for working families, middle class folks, those who aspire to be part of the middle class, young people, seniors, immigrants, veterans, the poor, the sick, the afflicted, the least, the lost, and the left behind. House Democrats fight for the people. That's our story, that's our legacy, that's our values, That's our commitment as we move forward. Get stuff done. Make life better for everyday Americans. We look forward to finding opportunities to partner with the other side of the aisle and work with them whenever possible. But we will also push back against extremism whenever necessary. We love this country. We love our democracy. We love the Congress and the House of Representatives, the institution designed to be the closest to the people. And we're going to fight hard each and every day we have this honor to serve in Congress to deliver.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat from New York, at a news conference after being elected the House Democratic leader for the next Congress, will be minority leader standing beside him. The other new members of the leadership team, Catherine Clark, the whip, and Pete Aguilar, the caucus chair. The Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, will be staying on as majority leader in the next Congress. Senator Schumer speaking on the Senate floor today about how he and Hakeem Jeffries both grew up in the same place.
It's not surprising that House Democrats are turning to someone from Brooklyn to lead the way next year. Because when you're from Brooklyn, you learn quickly traits like persistence and serious mettle. It's a crowded place and a diverse place. You learn how to work with all kinds of different people. You learn how to stand your ground. You learn to not take things personally. Hakeem Jeffries exemplifies all these traits. He is someone who I know will both hold the line on our democratic values while being ready to listen and keep an open mind. I know he can work with the other side whenever it's necessary. Most importantly, he is dedicated to making our country a better, more prosperous place for all people from all walks of life.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor today. Congressman Jim Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina, the current minority whip and a senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus, has previously announced that he would not be running for any of the top three House Democratic leadership positions for the next Congress, but he'd like to stay in leadership, and he's running for the number four spot, assistant leader. Until today, he was unopposed, but this morning he got a challenge. Congressman David Cicilline, Democrat from Rhode Island. TheHill.com reports that Congressman Cicilline is currently a co-chair of the Congressional LGBTQ Plus Equality Caucus and cited the recent fatal shooting at a gay bar in Colorado as a driving factor behind his bid. He also noted that LGBTQ plus members in House Democratic leadership lost their races in this month's midterms. Sean Patrick Maloney of New York, chair of the caucus's campaign arm, and Mondaire Jones of New York, the freshman representative to leadership, both failed to secure re-election. The vote in that race between Congressman Clyburn and Congressman Cicilline among House Democrats is set for Thursday. Now to the House Republican leadership races and a possibly important set of meetings this week as the Republican Conference votes on proposed changes to House operating rules for the next Congress, when again they're going to be in the majority. Several conservative House Republicans have withheld support from the frontrunner for Speaker, the current minority leader Kevin McCarthy of California, and some of those same members have been asking for more power for the rank and file and how legislation is shaped. And with a slim House Republican majority, missing a handful of votes could keep Congressman McCarthy from reaching the 218 mark. That's a full House majority needed to be elected Speaker. Congressman Byron Donalds, Republican from Florida, spoke outside today's closed-door meeting.
Is Kevin McCarthy moving towards, you know, making some of the concessions that some of these folks want in order for him to get to the, you know, the magic 218 number? Because right. We spoke with a few of the folks today, and they said that they're not, you know, satisfied at all.
Well, I mean, look, first of all, these things take time. So I think, unfortunately, you know, in your profession, everybody's looking for an answer today, the headline today. But these are negotiations like anything else. So I think that they take time. They ebb and flow. They stop and start. The fact that we've gotten even this far, I think, is productive. And I think we're going to get into the right place.
And you think that McCarthy can get to 218?
Yeah, I do. I think we're going to get there. But again, guys, we got time. Like, that is a January 3rd vote. It is, what, still November? We're not even in December yet. So I think we'll get there. We're going to be fine. Republicans are prepared to govern. We're prepared to take control of this place and get back to work for the American people.
One last one.
Sure. I don't know. I don't know about that. I know, obviously, the five that are public. But look, having been through a leadership race here, seen them when I was at the state level, until people go up on the board, that's when it really matters. So I'm not going to really get into gossip about the numbers. I don't know.
Congressman Byron Donalds, Republican from Florida, speaking with reporters outside the closed meeting where they're discussing the rules changes. Also stopping by, Congressman Bob Good, Republican from Virginia, who does not support Kevin McCarthy for Speaker.
Well, the good news is the leadership challenge has encouraged the leadership to consider some changes that need to be made to how Congress operates, which is in the best interest of the country, as well as Republican voters who sent the people's representatives to make the change they want to be made in Washington. So there is some modest progress being made towards giving members a little better voice in what happens in Congress and a little bit more transfer of power down to the regular members instead of all of it being held at the top by the elite few.
Yeah, and from what we've been hearing, though, from those who oppose McCarthy, that it hasn't been enough to this point. You know, can you describe some of the sticking points?
Well, frankly, from my perspective and just speaking for myself, these discussions about how we ought to change how the conference operates and the Congress operates from a rule standpoint, things like allowing amendments if a certain number of memberships, percentage of members want to make amendments, things like a majority of the majority rule, vacating the chair provision to still be in place, amendments that empower, again, regular members. We work through committees. If we don't suspend the rules, those kind of things are better for the Congress and better for the country, irrespective of the leader situation. So from my perspective, those are separate.
Okay. And what do you see as the potential number of folks who are really willing to take this to the floor, you know, against the party, you know, with the situation?
Well, I'll point to what Andy Biggs said, who's the person that I voted for Speaker and who I'm currently supporting until another candidate emerges that might be, you know, more able to get to 218. Andy Biggs said he thought there was about 20, and I think he's in the ballpark. Thank you, guys.
Congressman Bob Good, Republican from Virginia, with reporters today on Capitol Hill. More on the race for House Speaker in the next Congress and the challenges that Congressman Kevin McCarthy is facing to get the votes he needs to be elected. Joining us on the phone is CQ Roll Call senior reporter Lindsay McPherson. Thanks so much for being with us. So 2 weeks since Congressman McCarthy was nominated, 5 weeks before the House floor vote, where does this race stand?
Well, right now, McCarthy does not have the votes to be elected Speaker in January. He's going to need a majority of the full House that is actually voting in the election. So if there are no absences, that is, and everyone votes for a member by name, that threshold is 218. Their present votes can lower that threshold somewhat in absences as well. But right now he's operating on, he needs 218 votes, and he knows he doesn't have that yet. There's going to be roughly a 4-seat margin when the final races are called in the House. There's two outstanding. That's what it's expected to be. And there's already five Republicans who have come out and said that they will not vote for him for Speaker. And there are others that are kind of holding their powder dry, waiting to see what happens in terms of some of the conference and House rule changes that they're seeking. Those are being debated. Actually, Republicans are meeting today to talk about the conference rules, and they've started discussions on House rules as well.
Are you hearing anything coming out of those closed-door meetings on the proposed rules changes that might be swaying some votes?
So far, not really. As McCarthy did meet with some of the Freedom Caucus members who are, you know, leading the opposition against him to discuss the rule changes yesterday in a closed-door meeting. I spoke with Freedom Caucus Chairman Scott Perry this morning, and he said that while there was some progress made in that, and McCarthy has started to agree to a few things, most of the what's been agreed to so far is what he called minutia. So smaller rule changes, well, you know, things they support, you know, aren't significant in the grand scheme of the things they're asking for. And some of their major proposals are being rejected or already have been. For example, you know, they wanted the committees to be able to vote for their committee leaders instead of the steering committee. That was rejected before Thanksgiving and the conference rules. Today, they're meeting and they're discussing whether to ban earmarks. And while they haven't tabulated the vote on that yet, it looks like based on what members are saying that that's not going to, the ban is not going to pass, that they'll keep earmarks in the spending bills, which Democrats reinstated. Freedom Caucus members wanted to get rid of that. Perry had told me that was going to be an important marker in how they view things with McCarthy. So right now, some of the big changes they're asking for aren't getting approved, and they're not seeing enough progress to change their minds yet. There's a long way to go between now and the January floor vote, so more could be agreed to, more deals could be cut, but at the moment, McCarthy doesn't have the votes.
We're talking with Lindsay McPherson from CQ Roll Call. So Congressman McCarthy vowing to stay in the race and take the fight to the floor if necessary, and the main opposition at the moment, Congressman Andy Biggs, saying he is still in the race. When was the last time we had this where it took more than one ballot to get a House Speaker?
It was almost 100 years ago, back in the 1920s. I don't have the exact year off the tip of my hand, but it was so long. I mean, it's not a historically precedent for a speaker to need to go to two ballots. So the fact that McCarthy is willing to take it there is interesting in and of itself. I mean, obviously he's hoping it doesn't come to that, and kind of him saying he's going to take the fight all the way to the floor is kind of a negotiating tactic to let Republicans know he's not going to drop out no matter how much pressure they try to put on him. What happened in 2015, he was running for speaker after John Boehner was retiring, and he actually dropped out right before the conference vote because conservatives, including some in the Freedom Caucus, made clear they weren't going to support him. And so he's basically saying, I'm not going to do that again. You know, I'm not going to roll over for you guys, and you're going to have to get on board. So whether they do remains to be seen, but and we could have that floor fight where it goes to multiple ballots in January. We'll have to see.
And Congressman McCarthy even suggesting if this does go to the floor, and it's possible the Democrats could seize control, cut a deal with some moderate Republicans and elect a different speaker. How likely is that?
I mean, 0%. I don't know why people are talking about that. It's just not going to happen. That would be really unprecedented. And Jeffrey said today when he was asked whether Democrats would try to get involved in the speaker's race, that that's not, you know, they're not planning on that. And frankly, why would they help Republicans elect a speaker? It just doesn't make sense. So I know there's a couple moderate members that are talking about that just because they want to stir up relevance, but it's just, there's no way that happens. And that's just my opinion.
Lindsay McPherson is a senior reporter with CQ Roll Call. Find her stories at rollcall.com and on Twitter at Lindsay McPherson. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking today about the jury conviction Tuesday of two leaders of the right-wing militia group Oath Keepers of seditious conspiracy related to the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021.
Early yesterday evening, a jury in the District of Columbia found five defendants associated with the Oath Keepers guilty of serious crimes related to the January 6, 2021 attack on the United States Capitol. Two defendants were convicted of seditious conspiracy against the United States for conspiring to oppose by force the peaceful transfer of presidential power. Those two defendants and the three other defendants were also convicted of obstructing the certification of the Electoral College vote. And various defendants were also convicted of different additional felony counts, ranging from conspiring to prevent members of Congress from discharging their duties, to interfering with law enforcement officers attempting to guard the Capitol during the attack, to tampering with relevant evidence after the fact. These convictions were the result of tireless work by Justice Department agents, attorneys, analysts, and support staff, beginning in January 2021 with a methodical collection of evidence and continuing through the presentation of that evidence during the 7-week trial that began in October of 2022. Their skill and dedication are in the very best tradition of the Justice Department, and we are all extremely grateful to them. During the trial, the government's evidence showed that almost immediately following the November 2020 election, defendant Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, began planning to oppose by force the peaceful transfer of power. With Rhodes, defendants Kelly Meggs, Kenneth Harrelson, Jessica Watkins, and Thomas Caldwell communicated and planned to travel to Washington on or around January 6, 2021. On January 6, as the government's evidence showed, defendants Meggs, Harrelson, and Watkins forcefully breached the U.S. Capitol wearing paramilitary gear, while defendants Rhodes and Caldwell remained outside on the Capitol ground coordinating activities. Last evening, a jury of the defendants' peers found each of them guilty of serious felony offenses. As the verdict of this case makes clear, the department will work tirelessly to hold accountable those responsible for crimes related to the attack on our democracy on January 6, 2021.
Attorney General Merrick Garland, his statement today at the Justice Department. NBC News reporting in a terrorism advisory bulletin, the Department of Homeland Security on Wednesday raised concerns about potential threats to the LGBTQ, Jewish, and migrant communities from violent extremists inside the United States. The bulletin said some extremists have been inspired by recent attacks, including the shooting of an LGBTQ bar in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And the bulletin was the latest summary of national terrorism threats, a document that has been updated about every 6 months since the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. That from NBC News. Washington Today continues in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Welcome back to Washington Today. It's available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. The White House praising the Senate's passage Tuesday night of the Respect for Marriage Act. It gives protections to same-sex and interracial couples by requiring legal marriages performed in one state be recognized by other states. The final Senate vote was 61 to 36, with 12 Republicans joining Democrats in passing it. Those 12 are Roy Blunt, Richard Burr, Shelley Moore Capito, Susan Collins, Joni Ernst, Cynthia Lummis, Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman, Mitt Romney, Dan Sullivan, Tom Tillis, and Todd Young. The bill that passed the Senate includes a bipartisan amendment that deals with protections for religious liberties, so the bill will need to go back to the U.S. House for another vote before President Biden signs it into law. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre taking questions about this at today's briefing.
Ask you this. The president last night had a statement praising the Senate for passage of the Respect for Marriage Act. As you know, there are members of the LGBT community who argue that the bill is weak sauce. It doesn't go far enough to protect the rights of same-sex married couples in the event that Obergefell does get struck down. What's the White House's message to those who are concerned that the bill doesn't go far enough?
Look, you saw the president's statement last night. This is a huge step forward. And it is historic that we saw this movement from Congress in a bipartisan way to protect same-sex marriage. And I think, in the time that we're in, when we're talking about the differences between Republicans and Democrats and how we're not able to get things done, we're seeing that right now in an issue, a key issue that matters to this community. Again, it's a step forward. There's still work to be done to get it across the finish line. But I do think, and we do think, it's something to celebrate. There's always going to be need to be more work to do in any legislation that's passed, right? We're always going to want it to be perfect. But I think it is important to note that we are taking, again, a historic step forward. The president is very proud of the work that Congress is doing this in a bipartisan way to deal with an issue that he has fought on for many years. And you've heard him say people should be allowed to choose who they love, and love is love.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who is the first openly LGBTQ person to hold that position. Sponsors of the bill that passed the Senate say it is needed because the Supreme Court's decision earlier this year that overturned a precedent on abortion constitutional rights uses the same reasoning, according to an opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas, that could overturn other precedents guaranteeing same-sex and interracial marriage rights. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, one of the no votes Tuesday night. He explained why on the Senate floor.
My colleagues have yet to offer even a single example of a same-sex marriage threatened by any current or pending state legislation. Not one, not a single one. And they intentionally misinterpret Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in Dobbs and claim that the sky is falling. But it's just not happening. Unfortunately, we are aware of case after case where individuals, charities, small businesses, religious schools, and religious institutions are being hauled into courts to defend themselves for living out their faith. These people are not committing hate crimes against their neighbors. No, they're not abusing peers for their personal choices either. No, they're being hauled into courts across this country for serving the poor, the needy, and the refugee in compliance with their sincerely held religious beliefs.
Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, on the Senate floor Tuesday before that final passage of the Marriage Equality Act. Washington Post adds this: the Respect for Marriage Act would not force states to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, but would require that people be considered married in any state as long as the marriage was valid in the state where it was performed. The bill would also repeal the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage as the union of one man and one woman, and allowed states to decline to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. That law has remained on the books despite being declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. President Biden speaking today at the Tribal Nations Summit at the Interior Department building in Washington, D.C. during this Native American Heritage Month. Associated Press writing that the president was there to make new commitments to Native American nations, including uniform standards for federal agencies to consult with tribes, a plan to revitalize Native languages, and new efforts to strengthen the tribal rights that are outlined in existing treaties with the U.S. government. Here's the president.
Today, I'm announcing even more critical actions that are the result of a meaningful and deliberate consultation process with you all. My administration listened. We heard you. And we're implementing many of the changes you asked for. Today, I signed a new presidential memorandum that improves consultation between the federal government and tribal nations based on key principles. Consultation has to be a two-way, nation-to-nation exchange of information. Federal agencies should strive to reach consensus among the tribes. And there should be adequate time for ample communication. Federal agencies should prepare a public record for what's transpired during those consultations. And tribal nations should know how their contributions influence the decision-making. And this is a new presidential memorandum requires all relevant federal agencies to get annual training on tribal consultation process. Let me say that again. All federal agencies. And so, folks, it's a whole changed approach.
President Joe Biden at the Tribal Nations Summit at the Interior Department building in Washington, attended by leaders and representatives from hundreds of Native American tribes. And this is the first in-person government summit on tribal affairs in 6 years. Last year's gathering was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and before that, former President Trump did not hold these summits. Now to the war in Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Bucharest, Romania, condemning Russia's targeting of Ukrainian civilians, saying at a news conference over the past several weeks, Russia has bombed out more than a third of Ukraine's energy system, plunging millions into cold, into darkness as frigid temperatures set in. Heat, water, electricity, for children, for the elder, for the sick. These are President Putin's new targets. This brutalization of Ukraine's people is barbaric. That from Secretary Blinken. The U.S. pledging more than $50 million in equipment to repair Ukraine's electricity grid. And today, a reporter asking Secretary Blinken if more can be done to prevent the Russian missiles from striking in the first place.
How does the U.S. ensure and commit to Ukraine that the energy infrastructure support that you and allies and partners are providing will not just be rapidly destroyed, as we know that those civilian infrastructure elements are among the most vulnerable? Are the U.S. and your allies and partners pairing the energy assistance with protection such as Patriots or other air defenses, or simply conceding that you will have to replace the same infrastructure again?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, you're exactly right. These are flip sides of the same coin. Even as we're working in a very coordinated way with countries around the world to help Ukraine repair and replace as necessary the infrastructure, the generators, the transformers, the grids that are being destroyed, we're also trying to be very deliberate, and this is primarily the Pentagon and others, in trying to establish the best possible defense for critical energy infrastructure in Ukraine so that we don't have a process that keeps repeating itself. Stuff gets replaced, it gets destroyed, it gets replaced again. So we have to do both, and we are doing both. I'll leave it to the planners and the strategists on the military defense side to speak more specifically about that. But yes, a part of this is making sure that not only are we getting Ukraine weapons that it continues to need to defend itself and ward off the Russian aggression, but that some of that is used in a very deliberate way to, as best possible, protect the energy infrastructure. But it's also critical that even as we're doing that, we, of course, help Ukrainians get things back online that have been taken offline by Russian bombs and missiles. That's where this very coordinated effort that we've been engaged in comes in, primarily through the G7 and a number of other countries, but also in close coordination with what the European Union is doing, and also institutions like the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And what we've established is very akin to what was done on the military equipment side in Ramstein. The same kind of process to make sure that Ukrainians are getting as quickly as we possibly can get it to them, everything they need to keep their electric grid going.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, a news conference today in Bucharest, Romania, at the close of a NATO foreign ministers meeting. President Biden's pick for the next U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, had a confirmation hearing today before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. She is a career diplomat, currently U.S. ambassador to Armenia, and was the second highest official at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow from 2014 through 2017. This question from Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire.
You have a very difficult challenge ahead, any ambassador to Russia would at this time, because on the one hand, it's important for future relationships to maintain that open channel of communication with Russia. On the other hand, we need to condemn their outrageous behavior in the war in Ukraine, the obvious war crimes that are being committed, the disinformation, the hostile activities that they're engaging in the United States and Europe and other parts of the world. So help me understand how you walk that fine line, and how do you raise those concerns while at the same time trying to keep an open channel of communication?
Senator, I faced some of these same difficulties when I was the deputy chief of mission in Moscow, and I found it very important to be professional and to be prepared in these conversations with Russian officials, but to also be frank and candid. And I think there's a way to do that that, as I said, it can be effective in ensuring that there are not misperceptions. But it isn't easy, having had that seat, as I said, as the deputy. You know, publicly, I think we have a lot of tools through our public diplomacy platform, our social media tools, to publicly be messaging about all the concerns that we have, and to shine a light, to expose the untold suffering that Russia has inflicted on Ukraine. I think that that is absolutely necessary so that there is no question about it. But this is a tough environment. It's tough to sometimes penetrate through the propaganda when people have been drinking Kool-Aid for a long time. You know, it's hard to get them to take water. But I think we have to keep trying there.
Lynn Tracy nominated for U.S. Ambassador to Russia before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The question from Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire. If she is confirmed, she'll take over for former Ambassador John Sullivan, who left at the start of November and plans to retire. Also, Russia unilaterally postponing this week talks with the U.S. about the New START Treaty, Strategic Nuclear Arms Control talks, citing political reasons. And today, RT.com writes that Russia sees no possibility of resuming talks with Washington on the cornerstone New START Arms Control Treaty while the U.S. continues to arm Russia, Russia's foreign ministry spokesman said on Wednesday. This is Washington Today. At the White House, First Lady Jill Biden giving a preview of the first White House state dinner of the Biden administration. It will be on Thursday. The honored guests are the French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife. COVID-19 has prevented these in-person elaborate affairs until now. The First Lady at the White House, along with the White House Social Secretary, Executive Chef, and Executive Pastry Chef.
We are so glad to welcome them to the White House as the first couple of our oldest ally, France. The design of this dinner was inspired by the shared colors of our flags, red, white, and blue, and our common values, liberty and democracy, equality and fellowship. These form the bedrock upon which our enduring friendship was built. On the tables are vivid red roses and blue delphiniums alongside white irises, which are the symbols of our nation's capital and of France, their intricate petals reflecting the interwoven history of our nations. Our chefs, Chris and Susie, have put together such a thoughtful menu for this event. And I'm especially excited that we are featuring American cheeses for our cheese course, including Rogue River Blue, the champion of the 2019 World Cheese Awards. We chose John Batiste as our entertainer for the evening, a performer who grew up in New Orleans, which has been shaped by both French and American culture. From playing in Seminole brass bands to leading Louisiana Postal Workers Union during the Civil Rights Movement, the Batiste family has been a part of American history. Tomorrow, we are adding a state dinner to that remarkable list. And throughout the dinner, from images on the pavilion walls to the chandeliers that will hang above us to the dishes and displays on the tables, are symbols and celebrations of the many ties that bind our nation together.
First Lady Jill Biden at the White House talking about Thursday's state dinner with the visiting president and First Lady of France. The state visit will also include an elaborate White House arrival ceremony and joint press conference, and then that black tie dinner. We'll have extensive coverage on C-SPAN Radio and C-SPAN Television, also at cspan.org and on our mobile app, C-SPAN Now. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories making news in Washington. Sent directly to your inbox. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.